Welcome back to Word Up with Dani Katz. I am your host, Dani Katz. I am an author, journalist, and a quantum languaging coach and consultant. What that means is that I teach people how language programs consciousness, how language programs reality at large, and how to transform reality and evolve our consciousness with language. I've also been known to cultivate and share an opinion or two or 12 about culture and consciousness and how they are evolving, devolving, and being manipulated by the powers that were. Here at Word Up, we are devoted to fostering critical thinking while supporting you in becoming your most authentic, empowered, liberated, realized, amazing version of yourself. Our every show aims to expand your consciousness, raise your frequency, sharpen your critical thinking skills, and make you giggle. And think. Given the radical uptick in censorship over the past few years, combined with the complete co-opting slash decimation of my own personal industry, journalism, I started Word Up to have a free speech-friendly platform in which to engage exploratory, solutions-based conversations with visionaries, mystics, original thinkers, and rebel badasses who are helping to make the world more wonderful. The first half of my interviews run between 30 to 90 minutes and are always posted here for free public listening. The second halves are reserved for paid supporters on my Patreon and my Locals platforms, where for as little as $5 a month, you can access all of my second half conversations along with oodles of other bonus content and opportunities to drop in with me, to drop in with our High Vibe tribe, and lots of other awesome things. In addition to interviews, Word Up also features quantum languaging upgrades, planetary service announcements, and propaganda analysis, which I call Spot the Propaganda. Thank you so much for tuning in and for sharing your sacred attention with me and our High Vibe tribe of change makers. Be sure to click that subscribe button so you can stay abreast of our every episode. Thank you for also clicking the like button, for sharing far and wide, and for leaving some kind words as a review as you are authentically inspired. As well, if you are gleaning any value whatsoever from these shows, consider supporting me on Locals and or Patreon. And as you are wanting to learn more about my quantum languaging coaching and consulting services or nab copies of my books, find me on DaniKatz.com as well as on quantumlanguaging.com. Okay, I think that's it for our housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy this episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Hey, superstars, welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Today I am joined by Robert Frederick. Robert Frederick is the genius researcher and the very resonant voice behind the Hidden Life is Best podcast, which explores the colorful history of Francis Bacon and the very well-researched notion that Francis Bacon was truly William Shakespeare, or at least the man behind the William Shakespeare production team, mythology, etc., etc. This is one of the most fascinating podcasts I've yet come across. And Robert goes really deep linking Francis Bacon and Shakespeare to Gnosticism, to the birth of scientism, to the birth of intelligence operations, espionage. It's really, really juicy stuff. So I have been trying to get Robert on the podcast for months, gently prodding, not so gently prodding. I was so excited when I finally got the yes. So I know you are going to enjoy today's rollicking conversation about Francis Bacon and the William Shakespeare op. Welcome to the podcast, Robert Frederick. You are the creator of one of my very favorite podcasts of all time, The Hidden Life
is best, the story of Francis Bacon and William Shakespeare. And so I'm hoping you can catch, just to start us out, catch my audience up to speed as to what The Hidden Life is Best is and what inspired you to launch this podcast.
Okay. Thank you so much for the compliment. Well, that's a big question. What inspired me? Basically, my search since a youth for why is the world so screwed up? When almost everyone you meet seems decent and fair and reasonably intelligent. And I just couldn't get it, couldn't grasp it. And, you know, kind of freelance, just looking around, eventually led me to like the obvious English Empire problem. They'd gone all over the world, and wherever they were, there were problems. And I was, you know, that was on my radar, and I was reading and looking around and not intent on solving this problem, but it was just a question in my mind for many, many years. And I was listening to another podcast, and the guy mentioned Francis Bacon as being part of the Jamestown colony. And that blew my mind because he was sort of on my radar too, sort of. And I think I had heard about the Shakespeare authorship controversy by then. And what happened was right at that moment when I finished listening to that podcast and wrote a friend of mine about it, who's a history nut. It was all about the Susquehanna River. You know this person.
We're talking about Michael?
Yeah, Susquehanna River Alchemy. I forgot his name.
Michael Wan.
Michael Wan. I listened to him talking about this Susquehanna River, and I went to college on the Susquehanna River, and I shoot an email to my friend who's a history buff. He's not a conspiracy guy at all, but he's a big history buff, and it was all about the Susquehanna River, and we once lived on the Susquehanna River, and I was just like, wow, I'm sending him like all this stuff. And I mentioned Francis Bacon at least three times. I closed the email, and I picked up a book that I had just thrown on the bed as something to look at that I'd never even opened this book, but I had probably found it on the street here in New York. I opened the book completely at random, and I look at the bottom of a page near the end of the book completely at random, and my eyes fell on the two words Francis Bacon.
Ooh.
And I was completely stunned, and the name of the book is The Roots of Coincidence by what's his name? The famous author from the last century. His name will come to me in a minute. And it was a kind of like a double synchronicity, double coincidence. And I thought, well, I got to look into Francis Bacon. And that started me off. And the more I looked, the more I was flabbergasted because he rose to nearly become King of England. He was what's called Lord Chancellor, which is the number two spot. He strongly, strong, overwhelming evidence that he was William Shakespeare. He's known as the father of modern science. So his day job, his day reputation as father of modern science, literally the beginning of the Enlightenment, they say Francis Bacon, because of his philosophy. His day reputation is as a philosopher. But he was also rose to the top of power in England. He was a statesman. He was heavily involved in the espionage world since a very young man. What else for the daytime Francis Bacon? Lord Chancellor, Attorney General. He's known as one of the greatest lawyers in English history. So in a certain way, one of the top lawyers of all time. And then, what else daytime? Just very influential, but almost nobody's really heard of him. His reputation has fallen off. He didn't actually make any scientific discoveries. He was more a philosopher of science, a cheerleader of science, which was really on my radar because of what I had perceived to be scientism and this irrational faith in science, which is very hard to talk about in and of itself. Like people just kind of can't grasp it. They can't get their head around it. What do you mean? So that's one whole area. But then what you find out is the connection to Shakespeare, which is a whole topic that takes, you know, tons of research. But to me, it's overwhelming that he was William Shakespeare and probably head of a group of people that was William Shakespeare. So already, like, that's just completely and totally mind-blowing to me, for someone who's interested in deception and hidden history and the history of the world and the English Empire. But it keeps going. He is very much implicated in starting modern Freemasonry, which is another, like, overwhelmingly giant topic. And he's definitely, in my opinion, but he's very, very closely associated with the Rosicrucian movement. Another huge topic, but they're intimately related to the Freemasons. And all of this hidden stuff is tied in with the occult and the mystery religions, which is what Freemasonry is tied into. And it doesn't even really stop there. I mean, he was involved in Jamestown, settling Jamestown. He was very close with Sir Walter Raleigh. So he was very involved in co the colonizing scheme because he really felt like England should rule the world. And this whole British Empire thing started technically with him and Jamestown. It was already going in Ireland, and it was John Dee who coined the term British Empire. But him and John Dee were very close. And then we're back into the occult. And he's also, and the birth of capitalism. It was Francis Bacon who suggested loaning money at interest should be legal again because it was banned as usury at the time. And it kind of goes on. I'm forgetting a couple maybe minor things, but to me, the story just completely staggered me. And I thought, you know, the best way to do this is do a podcast about it and see where it goes as you study, because I had enough information to start putting it out there. And the goal is to write a book. I'm writing a book about it, but I needed so much more research. You know, every time you read a scholarly book, you look in the back and there's like 100 books. Like, oh, I got to read 100 books to write a book. So I realize now, of course, because I'm not a trained scholar, that they don't read all those books, but they reference them and they saw them and they looked up things in them or whatever. Maybe some of these people did read them all. But anyway, it's a way to start writing the book is to do the podcast. And it's changed my life, and I've become one of a fairly long line of bacon obsessives, which is another story. Just like all of these sections are another story, like Shakespeare is. You know, not only 36 plays, but it's the whole history of Shakespeare's impact on the world. You could write a book about the history of Shakespeare scholarship. And since this woman named Delia Bacon, no relation, an American woman, had this idea first. She was the first one to write a book about it. But the rumor that Francis Bacon was William Shakespeare really started during his lifetime. It actually started immediately after the first Shakespeare poem was published. In 1593 or 1594. She, in like the 1850s, was there's no way William of Stratford wrote Shakespeare. And she wrote a book, I can't remember the title of, but it had a big impact. And the whole Baconian theory of Shakespeare authorship began. Mark Twain read the book. Mark Twain became a big proponent of Bacon as Shakespeare. And his very last book is called Is Shakespeare Dead? It's a very, very funny synopsis or retelling of the whole theory. He's really angry because, as a brilliant writer and as a commoner genius, he's kind of mad that people were fooled by thinking that this commoner was a genius in England when there's nothing common about the writing at all. But anyway, I'm getting into the weeds in one of these like six huge categories that I'm trying to cope with here.
That was great. That was a great intro, Robert, and thank you so much. It feels like, I mean, I love so much about the podcast, but it feels like it's a main artery for what's going on now. And that if we want to understand what's happening in our world now, that this is a really good way to unpack so many of the different tendrils. But before we go down that road, I'm curious about you and your background. Are you a journalist? Are you a researcher? Even on your hidden now. I don't know if Robert Frederick is your real name or if that is a nom de plume. And then the website itself is all about the work, but not a lot about you. So as much as you're willing to share, I'd be curious to know what led you into this realm of study.
It just kind of being interested in everything, which is a blessing and a curse. And moving to New York, I studied art at university. I'm p even picking up English isms in England. They call it university or uni.
Yes.
In college, I got a degree in art. I had been very interested in architecture, interested in everything. Love music. I switched over to being a musician, which is why I put some of my own songs at the end of every podcast. The
Cool.
songwriter, artist. If you know anything about New York, I was a downtown guy in New York. And in those days, the old days, the 80s, it was still an intellectual town. It's kind of gone. And I wasn't in that world because that's a very, graduate level world, but Susan Sontag was still famous, and the Worcester Group and avant-garde art and poetry readings were still important. Going back to the 60s, the golden age of New York City was probably late 50s, early 60s, when poetry was important and politics were important, like real thinking, folk music, jazz. There was still that legacy in New York City. And this book, The Roots of Coincidence, I probably bought it on the street for 50 cents. There used to be books for sale everywhere in New York City. There are hundreds of used bookstores and people to talk to about this stuff. It was a very different town than it is now. It's now very woke, very lefty. I guess it was always lefty, but as we know, the left has changed completely. And so it was that that got me just always exploring, always talking, kind of interested in everything, science, mysticism, history, art, painting, music, somewhat poetry, literature. I really wanted to know, all the great writers. But that was the world I was in. It wasn't, now it sounds weird. Why would you want to know all the great writers? You sound like a weirdo. That was normal. It's not weird. It was like, yeah, have you read Dostoevsky yet? How much of Dostoevsky? Have you read The Brothers Karamazov? And Henry Miller was really big. And Henry Miller at that time was very important to all of us. And he gives you that jet propulsion, to explore the world intellectually and otherwise. So yeah, there's, and then this coincidence happened just a few years ago. I don't even know the date, but it was probably about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And it completely changed my life. Carl Jung, we used to read Carl Jung. We used to read everything. And then, and this synchronicity, I thought, I have to pay attention to this synchronicity. And this door opened into this crazy world. And sometimes I still can't believe what I now believe. It's in the podcast. And I just finished an episode 14, Shakespeare and the Occult, Part Two, about androgyny, which I didn't even realize was such a huge part of the occult, but, and I got it from Shakespeare. I'm looking at this Shakespeare play, As You Like It. Central motif is androgyny, which ostensibly it's about love, romantic love, and marriage. But as you get trained to do what they call a deep reading, which I'm not trained to do, I'm not even sure I'm doing a deep reading, but it comes from, and I'm sure you look at cinema a different way once you learn how they make movies and how movies are made and symbolism and all of that stuff. You look at all this stuff differently. And so anyway, looking at androgyny instead of Rosalind, who's a very famous Shakespearean character. She's almost a feminist hero, because Shakespeare supposedly wrote about women in a new way that nobody had ever written about women before. That's another part of Shakespeare history. He's dressed as a man the entire play for no good reason. So I finished episode one, Shakespeare and the Occult, and said, well, I gotta look into androgyny. And I was like, boom, like what? Everything. And of course, it connects deeply to the current situation we're in with this transgender agenda. Is tied in with androgyny, and androgyny is all, alchemy is all about androgyny. the mystery religions, not the mystery religions, but the mystery cults and the ancient religions, the primary symbol was androgyny. And it turns out that Shakespeare, I'll say Shakespeare and Bacon interchangeably, when I discuss the writer of the plays, there's seven Shakespeare plays out of the original 36 in the famous First Folio that androgyny is a primary motif in the play. So I just put this episode out, episode 14. It'll be out soon, and I'm still like just stunned. I had no idea, and there was a direct connection to present day issues we're having. And it connects directly to England. Like, England is pushing this the hardest, besides the US, which is on the train. We're really one and the same. The English Empire and the American Empire are more or less ex almost exactly the same. Not, that's not true. They're not exactly the same. But the Commonwealth countries of Britain are pushing this androgyny agenda the hardest. And it's not an accident. And it started with this occult religion that is their secret religion. And when I say that, I still feel like I'm half crazy, like, to believe that, even though I know it's true. Like, it's there. There's overwhelming evidence steeped in the Shakespeare plays, in the Freemasonry, the Templars, everything. Everything just seems to fall back and make perfect sense. But it's crazy. And the central motif is that human beings believe they can become God. Like, that's what Gnosticism is. So Gnosticism is a whole other huge part of this discovery. And part of how I got onto this, from a book I read by a very famous guy who believes in Atlantis. He's got a show out right now. Very famous guy. His name will come to me.
Oh, is it Dark Journalist? He talks about Atlantis a lot.
No, he my Randall, he writes about ancient civilizations. Big show on Netflix right now, super famous. I want to say not Randall Carlson, super famous guy, big name. His name will come to me in a minute. He
Okay.
happened to write this book about Gnosticism and seemingly exposing it, but actually kind of praising it as a secret agenda. And there's a lot of praise for Gnosticism right now, starting with Elaine Pagel's book called The Gnostic Gospels, 1979. Everybody read it. It was a huge hit. You'll read that book and you won't realize that the Gnostics actually believe that the world was formed by an evil demiurge, and that the world is evil and your sole job is to escape the world. And that's where androgyny comes in, because when you're androgynous, you've escaped the binary reality. You escaped mundane existence. And in terms of ancient religion, you've imitated your God, which a lot of ancient religion was about imitating the gods. So I don't know. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
Yeah, I mean, it gives us a great background. Were you into conspiracies, the
Oh,
occult,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
societies before diving into this?
I was into conspiracies, yeah. And
Okay.
that started with probably Dave McGowan. I don't know if you're familiar with Dave.
I'm not. What crossed you over the edge? I know you
Oh,
said you
good
worked out.
question. Yeah, that's a great question. I was just talking about it with some friends. Again, like, kind of thinking, like, what is wrong? Like, why are there so many problems when there's so many solutions? And I'd say there must be a secret government and really in control. And I'd immediately shut myself down. This big voice would go, "That's crazy. How could that be? Look, everything's out in the open. You know how everything's done." And I go, "Yeah, it's true. Everything, this is America." Until one day, I think it was Freedom from Fascism, that Aaron Rodgers movie. Not Aaron. Yeah, Aaron Russo, Aaron Rodgers. And right behind it was, I think it was Dave McGowan's wagging the moon doggy about the moon landing, which really shook me up. Like, to say the moon landing was fake really shook me up. But I was also very excited about it. And I wanted to talk to people about it. And I would say, look, here are the facts. Look. And of course, nobody listens to the facts. You can't convince someone with facts about something like the moon landing. I mean, you can. I think I'm wearing a couple people down. And I don't even really talk about this stuff that much. That's one reason why the podcast is great. It gives me an outlet. But yes, I am definitely deep into conspiracy land because that, like the story of the moon landing or JFK, when you start to see that that's true, we are the people of stories, and those become the best stories. I want to know more about this story. We are made up of stories, I think. And that's one reason for the power of Francis Bacon. He knew that. And all those are stories that grip us in various ways. And so those stories became fascinating to me, and I'm still fascinated by them. And yeah, frankly, I'm addicted to it. I don't like that people call it conspiratainment because not all stories are entertaining. It's more like knowledge. Even knowledge itself is a story. So it's wanting to know more, really. And you need to make a balance with it. I think you must know this from yourself and your friends, and that it's easy to go overboard and start to, it's hard to know what to believe. And that's a general truth about life. That's what religion and philosophy and government are about, like determining what's true. So you get into that whole head, especially with the podcast, and which becomes about religion. Gnosticism is really about comparative religion because the Gnostics literally sucked in every single existing religion, becomes a part of Gnosticism, including Christianity. Including Judaism, which it, on the surface, it's a complete rejection of Judaism because they think Yahweh is evil or at best incompetent. That's not even at best. No, they really do think he's evil. But they'll still take in Jewish elements, and their Gnosticism might have come out of the Jewish world. They don't really know exactly how Gnosticism began. It's very weird, but something happened. When people, instead of, because of course the idea that the world is difficult or false, or there's a truer world, nobody ever thought of the world as evil. The Buddhists, of course, want to escape it. The Hindus see it as illusion. Plato with the higher realms and the forms. Christianity, of course, involves a certain rejection of the world or a certain wanting to be pure of the world. But the Gnostics went into its full-blown evil, the world. And that's kind of crazy. I think that's a definition of insanity. And then they would confront that belief system either by being very pure and kind of being like the monk in the cave or the Buddhist monk who eats one meal a day, is celibate, shaves their head, wears only robes. There was that Gnostic path, and then there was the path of absolute libertinism, antinomian rejection of all morality. There's no distinction. So this idea there's no distinction between men and women, there's no distinction between good and evil. And that they have no trouble holding on to that and appearing to be very good. And maybe even believing themselves to be very good and going to church on Sunday, and then God knows what they're doing in the dark hours, but it doesn't bother them emotionally. Like most of us feel guilty if we tell a lie. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, I had to lie my way out of that. Oh, so many of us are like that. We said a mean thing to someone 10 years ago and it still haunts us.
Totally.
And these people are like, yeah, I didn't want to say what they're doing. We all know what they're doing. They're starting wars, for instance. There's no guilt, no sense of shame or guilt. So this duality affects them psychologically. And I see all of this as really psychological, emotional, spiritual. And yeah, the occult is very interesting. No, I was not into the occult. I was into mysticism. I was into things like The Tao of Physics and The Dancing Wuli Masters. These were big books. Oh,
Capra.
sorry. Yeah.
Jeff
These were really
Capra.
big books in the 80s.
Yeah.
I still think there's some validity to them, but I can't really say because I don't know advanced math. But I try to keep an ear on that current scientific thinking as well. But yeah, the occult is really fascinating, and I just really learned a lot because I wanted to know a lot about it before I did this 14th episode. So I did a lot of reading on the history of religion, and I have a decent handle on what the occult means and what the mystery religions were, what the ancient religions were like, some of them. Again, it's this gigantic topic, so I'm far from an expert, but I feel like I have a grounding now on what occult means.
Cool. I have so many questions that I'm doing my best to like organize
I
them.
understand. Yeah, it's such so crazy. It's so much information.
So much information. And
Yeah.
just so you know, when you were first putting them out, you didn't put them all out at once. It was like one episode, then the
Yeah.
next. My girlfriend Nicole and I were just like waiting.
Oh,
We text each other, the next one is out. And we were, it was
thanks.
like so exciting, kind of like old school radio shows or even old school TV where you actually had to exercise patience, wait for the next episode.
Interesting.
I'm curious to know what of the unpacking of the Shakespeare fiction, Bacon, like this enormous body of work,
Yeah.
what do you think is most relevant in helping us understand the world today in 2024? And I, just to give you one piece of guidance, I would love
Yeah.
you to talk about scientism because it just feels like this is kind of the nexus point
Yeah.
for like extreme scientism nonsense that we're wading through today.
Wow, great question. And I'm glad you pointed it to scientism. Yeah, that has to be the biggest issue right now, is scientism. And I have made friends from the podcast, and a friend of mine who's now writing about the history of science. Him and I have been corresponding, and he put it to me. He goes, Francis Bacon wasn't the father of modern science. He said Francis Bacon was the father of scientism. And that was a brilliant remark because that's exactly what he was. But he really does claim a strong place in the invention of modern science. And that was a prophecy, really. He saw the future and he saw how to get there. And his most famous quote is, knowledge is power. And to say it's power and not compassion or truth or justice or a better world, it's power. That's what he saw it as, and that's what he wanted for it. And of course, he didn't invent science. Science is just a part of human life. Like to build a house, you have to have science. You trial and error, even just trial and error, you're collecting data, you learn from someone else, you build a house, you cook a meal, you use the same methodology. His whole thing was that he just became a cheerleader for organizing it and separating it from alchemy. Alchemy was being practiced by individuals in private, keeping their secrets, their trade secrets, and they're all seeking to get rich, making gold or whatever. They claim that it was a spiritual path. I don't really believe that. I think they saw it as a way to transform the world, which is Gnostic. It turns out alchemy was started with Gnostics in ancient Egypt. All this stuff goes back to Gnosticism, ancient Egypt. But Bacon saw that if he could separate this data gathering, literally use that word, I think, this knowledge, this gaining, and he created what he called inductive reasoning to separate from deductive reasoning of Plato and Aristotle and the Greeks, which he thought wasn't productive. Because when you use inductive reasoning, you don't get truth. You get reasonably close approximation of something that will work. So you get something that works so that you can make technological change. And of course, Bacon couched it as a benefit for all humanity, that this science will benefit all humanity. And as with all this occult stuff, and as James Lindsay says, they marry a truth to a lie. That's true. Science can benefit us, and science is a good in life. And when you start to talk about scientism, people think you're anti-science, or you're a Lu not a Luddite. You're anti-science, caveman. You want to go back to the caveman days? It's not that at all. It's actually knowing what science is capable of and isn't capable of, and keeping science in its proper place. And Bacon foresaw that one day science would become the religion. And he wrote it, illustrated it, let's say, in the book The New Atlantis. And again, it's one of those, on the surface, you won't notice. It's just like a Shakespeare play, like As You Like It. It's kind of a silly romance, romp in the woods, blah, blah, people joking around. And the New Atlantis seems like just a fable. Some sailors went off and they found this utopia and they sailed home. But when you really dig in, and people are doing very close readings of the New Atlantis, it's very weird. It's very, very weird. And ostensibly, it's still a monarchy. Bacon really, really loved monarchy. But it's actually run by the scientists, and the scientists are treated like kings. And the scientists rule the island, and everyone's very docile. But even the word for the people is sheep-like. And they're carried around like kings, like Queen Elizabeth was. And the crux of it is, and you won't notice it until you do a deep reading, but there's certain things they don't expose the rest of the island to. They make certain discoveries they keep for themselves. And so they get everyone to believe in science, which means you believe in them. And then they have these secret powers. Again, just like the gods, they're turning themselves into gods. That's the whole thing in a nutshell. They're keeping these secret powers. And it's even said, it's even intimated in the book, which you wouldn't notice on first reading, that they can create the conditions to make people believe in spirituality. Like for some reason in this remote island in the South Pacific, they're Christian. And there's this whole story about how the Bible came to this land, and it was a kind of a hallucination. Because they're completely unconnected to Europe and the rest of the world. Nobody knows this island exists. It's called Bensalem. It's not even called the New Atlantis. That's just the name of the book. Atlantis is mentioned. The old Atlantis is mentioned in the book. But the whole name New Atlantis is complicated. But he foresaw scientists having the power that it took. He knew it would take a long time because it's hard for us to imagine how gripped people were by traditional religion in those days and how important it was and how it was used by the powers to keep people in line. But he did foresee, and he called it the Great Instauration, which I think is the Great Reset, that one day people would worship scientists as kings and that they would have the power of gods. And they've slowly. And it's not like Bacon did all this stuff and then it stopped. He trained people through Freemasonry and through his associates who knew the coded language. He even said, I write in code for initiates. He literally said that. And who somehow have continued this hoax that science actually has answered fundamental questions about life. And Darwinism is a great example of that. That was a big one too, when I realized Darwinism wasn't true. Neo-Darwinism isn't true. Because it's like, I don't know, what to compare it to? Santa Claus? You find out Santa Claus isn't real, or you find out that your, how about, these crazy stories where you find out your mother is actually your sister, that you were late chained, like Jack Nicholson's story or something like that. Like, it's,
Yeah.
what? Darwin is actually just another fable. And then you can find out how they did it. And Darwin was connected to the Huxleys and even said this is just theory. We actually don't have evidence for that, but they started fabricating evidence, and this Teilhard de Chardin created the Piltdown man hoax. He was a Jesuit priest who wanted to marry evolution with Christianity. But and then they teach it in school, even though it's a religion and we're not supposed to teach religion in school. We all got that. And then on the surface, it looks good. You go to the Museum of Natural History and they're, wow, our finger bones look like a whale's finger bones. And they tell you this story and you believe it, you buy it. They tell you the story and you believe it, and they take advantage of our credulity, our innocence. Most of us are innocent, good-hearted people. We're going to believe other people when they tell us things. We learn through life not to trust everyone and, check our sources and triangulate or whatever you and but the Darwin thing, it when I realized, like, and it's so easy to see, like, there isn't evidence for it. There's a complete lack of evidence for it. And then trying to talk to people about that, they just can't stand you. They just can't stand you. And you're just like, hey, listen, look what I learned. Look at it. And they're just like, what's wrong with you? You're crazy. Of course it's true. What do you think, man? You think God made the world? And you say, look, I don't know. I don't know how human beings developed. I do believe in a creator. You can say that, but they want to know. They think they know step by step. And there is scientism in a nutshell. I really do think Darwin was a key shift in scientism because people felt like that science had explained the origin and how life evolved. And then the moon landing, I think part of that was make apotheosizing science. So apotheosis is God making. They made science godlike that it could take us to the moon. And the moon is mythical, and that is the true power of science. We have left the earth, again, the Gnostic dream, to transcend the planet. Like, they can't stand the limitations of physical life. They can't stand that they're going to die. Yeah, I know, it sucks. There's a lot of things about life that suck, but they reject it all. And so all this imagery made science into godlike powers, and now they got 5 billion people to take an experimental gene therapy that triggers your genes, which they just discovered genes. It was 70 years ago. They didn't know they existed. And but that was so exciting when they discovered genes, because oh, that's how the mutations of Darwin work. Starts in the DNA. But real scientists know that DNA actually destroys Darwin. Because if you do any math, and all science needs math, calculating probabilities of something as complicated as DNA coming into existence randomly would take trillions and trillions of years if they do the math. And they say the world is 14.7 billion years old, which is pretty old, but not old enough for DNA to evolve. And of course, Darwin didn't even know what was inside a cell. They thought it was a walled protoplasm. So Darwin is failing in the scientific community now. You're not going to see that in the paper, just like you're not going to see that the North Pole is full of ice and temperatures haven't really been rising. The real scientists know that Darwinism is full of holes and is falling apart, and that even one cell is such a colossal mystery. One cell is like a mini city And for one cell to come into existence randomly is really impossible if you try to do the math for it. And they've even had to admit that we don't know how the cell began, much less life began. They've even kind of given up trying to explain how life began. Of course, now the alien thing, which they're getting us to believe in, which again came out of England, this whole alien thing. Oh, we're seeded, the spores were seeded from another planet, which of course doesn't explain anything. Because how did it begin on that planet? Just like the Big Bang doesn't explain anything, because what caused the Big Bang? I mean, they don't explain anything, but somehow they convince themselves that they've explained it, and it allows them to believe, and we all need to believe. So we get at the really fundamental nature of human consciousness. What is human consciousness? And I'm certain that Francis Bacon knew what that was, and that writing the Shakespeare plays was part of his scientific exploration of the human mind and the human heart. And he was gathering data to understand us. And that's why England has ruled the world, because they not only made their own race, their own people, their own island, like super patriotic, ready to not only wipe out the Irish, but go to India. Like, what are you doing in India? How many Britishers question that? Like, why are we there? Oh, it's the white man's burden. We have to help them. They told them a nice story, right? That's what they told the people of England. We're helping them. And they bought it because they're Christians. They're good Christians. I think that's how they bought it. I'm pretty sure that's they tell them stories. But how to tell the story is what Francis Bacon learned doing Shakespeare and other things. He's actually responsible for a lot more than that, hidden stuff he wrote. And it was for power. Knowledge is power. And those plays are very, very psychological, very emotional, and very philosophical. And they were used to manipulate the English public. The history plays prove it. That's now mainstream Shakespeare scholarship, that the 10 history plays, Henry IV, Henry V, Henry VI, Richard III, et cetera, Henry VIII. The history is all made up. It seems historical, but it's not. And that took like a couple hundred years to unravel before people realized, like, he made up the history. Oh, he made it up to legitimize the Tudors, because the Tudors were kind of illegitimate. So it was this whole massive social engineering. And that's really why, what I think, social engineering is what it was all about. And it came out of the intelligence agencies. Francis Bacon was at the heart of British intelligence, really the beginning of it. The big names are Francis Walsingham and Cecil, William Cecil. But that's what intelligence agencies do, right? That's what we're doing to us today, I think. And hence, people took this crazy medication because it's science. I hope that all sticks together somehow.
It does. It was great. And that was one of my biggest takeaways from your series is that this Shakespeare was a giant social engineering project. I was an English major in college, and of course it was required to take Shakespeare, and you pointed that out. Like, why does everyone have to read Shakespeare? Because in the grand scheme, like, it really isn't that good.
It's
Like,
not.
some pieces are, but in terms of like what is required for everyone on the planet reading, it's weird. Shakespeare. So was like did the Darwin narrative come out of Francis Bacon's social engineering? Like have you tied that together as far as the origin point? And was the point of that to separate us from God? Like what was the is that the function?
Yeah, that's part of it. The Darwin came before the Bacon.
Okay.
Richard, I'm having trouble remembering names right now. David, and not Horowitz. There's a great mathematician on YouTube. I can send you all these links. He
Cool.
destroys Darwin as a mathematician scientist in a brilliant 30 minutes. And he goes, everyone thinks people that don't believe in Darwin are Christian fundamentalists. He goes, I'm neither Christian nor a fundamentalist. He's a scientist, mathematician. And he talks about how we all talked about how Darwin was trash in the 60s. All these great mathematicians, like, it's trash. It's not science. The story. And that just blew my mind, that realization that I had been taught something that's not true as a certainty, and got me exploring the world of science. Like, who in the world of science is willing to say Darwin is false? Darwin does not hold up. And that was a fascinating journey, led me to Rupert Sheldrake, who's a very interesting scientist. But guess what? Rupert Sheldrake believes in evolution, Darwinian evolution. It was a huge disappointment. Yeah, huge disappointment. But he's still an interesting guy. And my friend Hans alerted me that he actually talks about Bacon in one of his books, that I had not come across that. So that's interesting. And Rupert Sheldrake pegs Bacon as the source of scientism. And Rupert Sheldrake really does attack scientism. I have no idea why he believes in Darwin as fact. He's retired. Maybe. You know what would be cool is if I ever get it together to do interviews, like all these people I would like to ask questions of, and maybe one day I'll do interviews like you're doing. But yeah, the Darwin got me broke open. Like, what else are we being lied to about? What's true? What isn't true in science? And it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. And then, so what do I believe? And you have to decide what you believe. But yeah, the way it comes through today, like you pointed out, and Bacon foresaw this, are these stories are gonna result in science being the true power. And of course, science was the path to power for the British Empire. Immediately, or not immediately, but it took 100 years or so. The Industrial Revolution began right there in London because of he pulled the scientists together, and they said, you know what, Bacon's right. We should all work together and share our data. And boom, the age of discovery began, or whatever they call it. And they consider that, because they're using reason. It's not religion, and it's not really philosophy. They're using reason to examine the natural world. It's the birth of the quote unquote Enlightenment. And he definitely saw where this was leading. And he even wrote about it. He wrote about the dangers of science. I mean, everyone knew it. In fact, it was kind of a religious thing. Like, don't try to get too much knowledge, because you'll get smacked down. There's the Tower of Babel myth, there's the Icarus. People knew that it was dangerous to go down the path of science. And Bacon acknowledged that. But he said, proper religion will keep it in check, or proper government. But he knew where it was going, and he did it for power. Knowledge is power. He did it for empire, to build empire. He was obsessed with building an empire, and especially one with a monarchy. And guess what we have? We have a British Empire that still has a monarchy. That's the only monarchy left standing, that of any worth. It's incredible. It's all just completely incredible. He did it. He hasn't done it. I mean, they've got a long way to go. But the fact is, the World Economic Forum really did originate in London. The Club of Rome really did originate in London, just like the Rosicrucians, which they put off onto Germany. It's all still out of London. Global warming thing, the pandemic response. They make it look like they're kind of clumsy and haphazard. They disappeared. They don't appear powerful. I say in the podcast, they slunk away behind the camouflage of the mushroom cloud that the Americans dropped in World War II. I mean, they started World War II, the Brits. There's some great books on that. World War II could have been avoided. World War I could have been avoided. There's some mind-blowing books of contemporary historians have uncovered a lot of this stuff, that they want these wars. They're war crazy. They're really crazy. And these are just the elite, not the English people, of course. It's the elite. We all suffer under these elite, who make themselves look caring and nice and concerned, because that's the story we're told, and that's the story we believe. They're master storytellers.
Indeed. Just before we hopped on, I was watching a video with Brett Weinstein, evolutionary biologist. And I always find it odd, like, how come humans are the only ones that have to have come from monkeys, but every other animal gets to just exist of its own accord? Like, if the ferret can be the ferret, the whale can be the whale, but we're so weird that we had to have been monkeys and then evolve into us. But then, so I was watching this video of Brett, and this was from a couple years ago. He was wearing a red bandana around his neck and explaining to his audience how this served to protect him. And I was like, this is so freaking asinine. And the only reason this is working is because he has this title, evolutionary biologist. And just seeing like the whole long game setup for what's propping up this nonsense we're living through now. And I've wondered, for a long time, I've thought the elites have to be working with a different understanding of time, a completely different paradigm of time that we're working with. And I had heard before I delved into your podcast, well, that does it for the first half of my conversation with Robert Frederick of the Hidden Life is Best podcast. As you would like to pick up the second half of the conversation, you can find that over on both my Patreon and Locals pages, where for as little as $5 a month, you can have access to not only the second half of this conversation with Robert Frederick, but to all of my second half conversations and my post-show throwdowns, plus oodles of bonus content. Those addresses are dannykatz.locals.com and patreon.com/dannykatz. Take your pick, choose both. Abundance is awesome. I personally always prefer and to or, and do what feels best to you. As you are inspired to learn more about me, my quantum languaging work, you can find more about me on dannykatz.com as well as quantumlanguaging.com. There you will have access to my books, my courses, my webinars, information on what it is like to do one-on-one coaching with me, and if you would like to bring me into your organization as a quantum languaging consultant to uplevel the communications paradigm in your own team. I'm also inviting you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. Given the copious amounts of big tech thought policing, it is at this point the very best way to ensure that we stay in touch. So be sure to do that at dannykatz.com. I think that does it. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. Have a rockin' day.
And for clicking that subscribe button, for liking, for sharing, for commenting, and for leaving some kind words as a review, as you are authentically inspired, as you are receiving any value from my podcast, as you dig it, as you listen regularly, consider supporting me on Patreon and/or Locals, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half podcast interviews, as well as oodles of bonus content. Your support really goes a long way in supporting me as a journalist and an independent content creator navigate her way through a really crunchy time in terms of free speech. And as you are wanting to learn more about my work in the world, my books, my products, my quantum languaging coaching and consulting, you can find me at dannykatz.com as well as quantumlanguaging.com. And if you're not down with a membership patronage platform and want to send me a one-time donation, you can use the Bitcoin link if it actually appears on your podcast listening platform. You could also send me a one-time donation by way of PayPal at dannykatz@pm.me or by way of Venmo, where my username is Sadie Bloom. Again, your support means the world and makes a massive, massive difference when it comes to continuing to share this work. with the world. Thank you for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that you are omniscopic amazingness and for having a rockin' day. See you next time, superstars.